नमः भगवते वासुदेवाय। नमः भगवते वासुदेवाय। नमः भगवते वासुदेवाय। Bhagavatam, Canto 10, Chapter 42, The Breaking of the Bow. Reading today, text 15 through 23. Text 15, word meanings, Tataha, then, Pauran, from the city residence, Pritchamanaha, inquiring about, Dhanushaha, of the bow, Sthanam, the place, Achyutaha, the infallible Supreme Lord, Tasmin, there, Pravishtaha, entering, Dadrishe, he saw, Danuhu, the bow, Aindram, that of Lord Indra, Iva, like, Adbhutam, amazing. Tata poram prichyamano Danusha stanamachyuta Tasmin pravishto dadrishe Danuraindram ivadbhutam Tata poram prichyamano Danusha stanamachyuta Tasmin pravishto dadrishe Danuraindram ivadbhutam Tataha pauram prichyamano Danusha stanamachyuta Tasmin pravishto dadrishe Dhanuraindram ivadbhutam Tasmin pravishto dadrishe Dhanurangramivadbhutam Tata poram prichyamano Dhanusha sthanamachyuta Tasmin pravishto dadrishe Dhanurangramivadbhutam Tataha param prichyamano Dhanushaha sthanamachyuta Tasmin pravishto dadrishe Dhanuraindram ivadbhutam Ladies. Tata poram prichyamano Dhanushaha sthanamachyuta Tasmin pravishto dadrishe Dhanurangram ivadbhutam Translation. Lord Krishna then asked the local people where the arena was in which the bow sacrifice would take place. When he went there, he saw the amazing bow, which resembled Lord Indra's. And we can chant the other verses together. Purushet
Chitam Paramartimat Varyamano Nibir Krishna Rahasya Adade.
That most opulent bow was guarded by a large company of men who were respectfully worshipping it. Krishna pushed his way forward and, despite the guards' attempts to stop him, picked it up.
Karena vamena saleya mudritam sajam chakritva nimishena pasyatam nimam vikshya prabhubhan jamadhyato yatayishitam.
Easily lifting the bow with his left hand, Lord Urukrama strung it in a fraction of a second as the king's guards looked on. He then powerfully pulled the string and snapped the bow in half, just as an excited elephant might break a stalk of sugar cane.
Dhanusha bhajyamanasya shodakam rudasidishaha puryayamasayam sutta kansasta samupagamat.
The sound of the bows breaking filled the earth and sky in all directions. Upon hearing it, Kamsa was struck with terror.
Tadrakshina sanucharam gupita atatayina vihito kama avagur jayatam hayatam iti.
The enraged guards then took up their weapons and, wanting to seize Krishna and his companions, surrounded them and shouted, "Grab him! Kill him!"
Ototan duravi prayan vilokya balakeshava purha bhambana adaya sakaletam shakmatmato.
Seeing the guards coming upon them with evil intent, Balaram and Keshava took up the two halves of the bow and began striking them down.
Balam cha kamsa prahitam hatva shala mukhatataha nishkramya chiraturishtau niriksha purasampadaha.
After also killing a contingent of soldiers sent by Kamsa, Krishna and Balaram left the sacrificial arena by its main gate and continued their walk about the city, happily looking at the opulent sights.
Tayostadbhutam viryam nishamya puravasinaha teja pragalbhyam rupam cha menire vibhurottamau.
Having witnessed the amazing deed Krishna and Balaram had performed, and seeing their strength, boldness, and beauty, the people of the city thought they must be two prominent demigods. This is the last verse.
Tayor vicharatos vairam adityostam upeivam Krishna Rama Vritavopai Purashakatam Iyatu.
As they strolled about at will, the sun began to set. So they left the city with the cowherd boys and returned to the cowherd's wagon encampment.
Om Jnana Timirandhasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshuran Miridamena Tasmai Sri Guruvaya Namaha. Sarva Vedanta Sarami Srimad Bhagavatam Mishyate Tadvrsamrita Tirtasya Nanyatisyad Vrati Kuchit.
Yesterday I was listening to a seminar by Radhika Raman Prabhu, Ravi Gupta, about the Bhagavatam, 2-day seminar he gave, Tawako I think it was. He was glorifying the Bhagavatam. Very nice. He's so learned, amazingly learned person. One of the things he was pointing out was that not only is the Bhagavatam the highest philosophy, but it's also kavya. Kavya means poetry. Often in the Vedic scriptures where there's philosophy, Then it's written in prose, and because it's easier to explain things in prose. So not only is the Bhagavatam explaining the most difficult subjects, but it's doing it in the most beautiful poetry also. And he was explaining how there are different meters. Of course, meters in the Bhagavatam, just like here, we had all of these were the same meter. I forget what it's called. This is like the Bhagavad Gita meter, very simple. I think it's 8 syllables, if I remember right. But there was one verse that came up there. It was a longer one. Actually, the meter of that verse is the same as the Tavakatamritam Taptajivanam Kavibiriritam Kalmashapaham that the Gopis, Gopi Gita. That meter is called Rajahamsa, the King of Swans. That's a beautiful meter. So we see that even in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna usually uses this shorter 8-syllable one. But sometimes at certain points, he uses the other one. So this is all part of the poetry to make an effect. For example, when in the first chapter, it's all of it, or at least most of it, is this 8-syllable meter. But then when Krishna accepts Arjuna as his spiritual master, then Krishna switches to another meter, a longer meter. And also in the 11th chapter, which is, you might say it's quite a unique chapter in the Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna is seeing the universal form, so there's so much awe in that chapter. There you also see the longer verses there. And so this is part of the exquisiteness of the Srimad Bhagavatam. He also, I've just got this is on my mind, so I've been thinking about it because I listened to this just yesterday. He talks about how, of course, he went to Oxford, and one of his professors there was a big, big scholar from South India. And I think he's from the Sri Sampradaya, if I remember correctly. He gave his name, but I don't remember it. But this person is so learned. Yesterday, Madan Mohan and I were talking about it. He was reminding me that Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya had memorized some whole library somewhere because he couldn't check the books out, so he just memorized the whole library. So there are still people around like that practically. This professor, he's not only a Sanskrit professor, but basically he knows everything there is to know about the Vedas. So he was a visiting professor at Oxford, and he was saying something about this scholar, such a big scholar, that when he was 16 years old, he got this title, I don't know what it's called, something in Sanskrit. He speaks in Sanskrit, just you know, like we speak English, he speaks Sanskrit. And he has like these different titles, you might say. One of them is someone who can just invent poetry on the spot for any occasion. So he also has something, one title, it's 8 something or other, I forget what it is. But the way this works, to get this title, you sit in a circle of 8 brahmanas, and you have to interact with each one of them, one after the other. And he gave like an example, like in one of them, you have to create a bunch of Sanskrit verses or something, word by word, and they have to follow all these particular rules, and you have to respond to what the other person says. So you interact with this one person, and you say something in Sanskrit, and he says something back, and you have to remember what the person said, because when you get back to him, when you come around the other 8, then you have to continue where you left off with this person. So you're doing that with at least 7 or 8, because one of the persons who's behind you is throwing flowers at you randomly at the back of your head, and you have to tell when you're done how many times you hit the back of your head with a flower. So this is the kind of brain, you know, some people have. It's all going on in Sanskrit. So this is one of his professors. And this professor he was talking to him. Of course, he knows everything. And the professor was telling him that, of course, I've read the Bhagavatam before, but you know, I read so many things, but now you know, I've been reading it, and I'm just so impressed. He said, there's nothing that compares with the Srimad Bhagavatam in the Vedic literature. Not only in the depth of wisdom there, but in the beauty of the poetry, in the beauty of the language. In fact, one of the points Radhika Raman was pointing out, he said, there are two kinds of Sanskrit, generally, it's divided. There's the Vedic Sanskrit, which we find like in the Rig Veda, and in the original Shruti, Vedic Sanskrit. And that Sanskrit is so difficult. First of all, when you chant that Sanskrit, it's not only that you have to pronounce it right, but there, you have to get the pitch right also. There are tunes, and you have to get those, or you have to sing it on in the right key exactly. And there are at least 3 different keys that you can do it in, chant the Vedic mantras. So there's the Vedic Sanskrit, and then there's what's called the classical Sanskrit, which is what most of the Puranas are written in, the Mahabharata. But the Bhagavatam actually has the Vedic Sanskrit in it. And another thing that's amazing about the Bhagavatam is that it has words that you don't find anywhere else in Vedic literature. So that's one reason why you need people like Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur and Sridhar Swami and so on to tell you what it says, because even if you're a Vedic scholar, you probably can't understand what it says, because you have to sort of like penetrate into the intricacies of the Vedic language to figure out what the words mean. And what they mean, of course, in the context, you have to really know the, you have to know the purport of the Bhagavatam to understand what the words mean. So the Bhagavatam is just this amazing literature that we have. Of course, Lord Chaitanya, he based everything he taught on the Srimad Bhagavatam. Everything is there in the Bhagavatam. All philosophy needed for human life is present in the Srimad Bhagavatam. So we go, of course, through all different subjects in the Srimad Bhagavatam, and now we're reading this nectar section. I love this section. For some reason, I've always liked this section of Krishna and Balaram coming into Mathura. These two country boys, you know, they're coming to the city for the first time in their life. And, of course, they've just left this heart-wrenching scene of leaving Vrindavan. But now we see that, you know, the whole picture of they arrive into town at night. When you travel, I haven't been probably traveling all day. So the old folks, they just want to settle in. And but the kids are like, well, let's go exploring, huh? Let's check out the scene. So it's Krishna and Balaram with their cowherd boys. We haven't heard about the cowherd boys too much lately. We hear about them earlier in Krishna's Leela. Because when Krishna starts maturing a little bit, then it's a little bit more about the gopis. So now, but here they are with their buddies. They're going into town with their friends, have a little fun. And there's a line in this section in the Krishna book, which I've always remembered. Prabhupada here, he translates, and in the last verse we read today, it says, Tayo vicharato swayam. Tayo means as they. It also means, as they. Vicharato, charata, chara means to move. So as they moved about, swayam. So swa means one's own. So swayam means at will. So Prabhupada translates this in the Krishna book. The two boys strolled carefree through the street. Now Prabhupada adds this because it's not in the exactly in the Sanskrit. Not caring for the law and order of Kamsa. Yes, I always love this line. Not caring for the law and order of Kamsa. And we have this picture of them, this painting of them. Each one of them has one of the elephant tusks on their shoulders. So they're just, it's their town now. They're entered into Mathura now. Kamsa thinks he owns it, but he doesn't own it. The Krishna and Balaram are here. And also we were just reading how the residents of Mathura, I've been coming across this recently in different places in the Bhagavatam, how everybody knows about the pastimes of Krishna and Balaram. While they're basically, as soon as they happen, somehow or other, word spreads. Even Bhishma Dev, when he's passing away, he mentions Krishna and the gopis and the rasa dance. So even these kinds of things. So people know. So they've heard about Krishna and Balaram. Somehow Kamsa's yoga maya is covering him over because he hasn't quite gotten it yet. Yeah. That these are the, you know, one of these two is going to get me. So many demons are getting killed. And people are talking about all these things. And they've heard about how beautiful they are. So now they're walking into town. And everyone is just, even here we always hear these scenes about how the ladies, they forget to get, you know, they're half dressed or they got one earring on or things like that. So that's happening here also. They're so excited. Oh, they're fine. They're coming now. They're coming. The word is spreading. So they're looking at them and just astounded by their beauty. I was thinking recently of this idea about beauty and the most beautiful. It seems like our minds can only go a certain distance. Just like they have the phrase sometimes, even in mundane life, they may call, especially a woman, they may say she's a perfect beauty because there's no flaws. You know, her nose is a little too crooked or whatever. There's just, you couldn't imagine that anyone's face could be more beautiful, because what could you do to it? Because you only have two eyes, nose, mouth, ears, you know, what can you do with it? You get to a point where, well, that's it. But somehow, the prophet said something like, you know, according to the heavenly women, the women on the earth that look like horses, or something like that. So even the most beautiful woman on the earth, compared to the heavenly women of the heavenly planets, we can't imagine how beautiful they are. It's true, we can't actually imagine, because our imagination only goes so far. So then just imagine, how much more is Krishna's beauty? So somehow it's so astounding that, what we read in the Bhagavatam, for example, Rukmini's beauty, it was knocking the men off their horses. Actually, I was reading that recently, and I was thinking, geez, she's actually really young. She's probably only like 10, 11 years old or something, and here these lusty kshatriyas, you know, lusting over this prepubescent or barely pubescent girl. It doesn't sound exactly right. But in any case, her beauty is so astonishing that it's knocking them off their horses. And in the Bhagavatam, there are other places too. We hear, there's something I noticed, there's three or four places where it talks about how beautiful this young princess was. For example, Devahuti, how beautiful she was. So one thing that's mentioned in these girls, when they're beautiful, they always seem to be playing with a ball. There's something dangerous about women and balls, apparently, playing with balls. Because so don't watch women's basketball. It's probably bad for you. They're always mentioned as playing with a ball, and their beauty is so astounding. So in any case, Krishna and Balaram, they're so beautiful when they're coming into town. And they've already done some things. They already killed somebody. So now they're asking, what's next? Where's that bow we're hearing about? There's this big sacrifice going on. Where's that bow? We want to see where that bow is. So they're asking the people. Of course, everyone is really happy to give them directions. They're so overcome by their beauty and their everything about them. They're just so attractive. So they walk in. Well, one thing in the first verse we read today, it mentions the bow. It says, when he went there, it's one thing that also is interesting to me is that often it's in the singular. You know, it's Krishna and Balaram, but a lot of times it's just Krishna who's mentioned. I was just reading, because I wanted to read something about the Cowherd Boys, so I read this book called the Prayog Bhakti Rasarnava. Prayo is another way to say Sakyarasa, the Prayo Rasa. So Praya means dear. So the dear friends of Krishna. This book was written by a devotee called Nayanananda in 1731. And he comes in our line, Gaudiya Vaishnava. His whole lineage is given there. But there it's mentioned, he mentions, because there are four classes of cowherd boys. And the first class, the Sudit, they're called, Balaram belongs in that class. Those are those who are a little bit older than Krishna. So this author, Nayanananda, he says that don't think that Balaram is any different from Krishna. It's just two different bodies, that's all. It's the same person in two different bodies. So that can be one reason why Krishna is just mentioned, because Balaram, Krishna, Krishna, Balaram, they're the same. In one sense, they're one. They are close to being really one. So in any case, here it says, then Krishna was going there to this amazing bow which resembled Lord Indra. So in the Sanskrit, it's called Dhanur Indram. So you may know that the rainbow is called Indra Dhanu, the bow of Indra. So in the Krishna book, Prabhupada translates this. He says the bow was just like a rainbow. The bow of Indra, the rainbow. Because the rainbow is called Indra's bow. So Prabhupada says this bow was just like Indra's bow, which is the rainbow. It was so amazing. So we don't hear too much about the bow. We just hear that it was big. It was guarded by lots of men. And they were worshiping it. Which I wonder what that's all about, worshiping a bow. Probably the bow has some kind of history. Just like in the Ramayana, of course, that bow was there also, that King Dasharath had. Somewhere it was there in the courtyard or something. This bow, it took 300 men to lift it. Wasn't it Shiva's bow, I think? Yeah, it was Lord Shiva's bow. And then I guess it was Vasishta, he was visiting Dasharath one day, and he saw that Sita Devi was just, you know, it took 300 men to lift it, but Sita Devi was out playing, and she just sort of lifted it up. And so he said, oh, this is a special girl. He's going to need, I don't know if he said Bhagavan is going to have to marry her, or someone special is going to have to marry this girl who can lift this bow. So this bow also was quite astonishing, and it was being worshipped for some reason. And actually the sacrifice was centered around the bow. It was some sacrifice to honor the bow. So Ulukram is here, Lord Krishna is described. He lifted it just easily, his left hand. First he just walked through, it was surrounded by guards, and they just walked right through them, right past them. Probably just shocked them so much. What are these two doing? Nobody's coming through here. They just, before they could even think what was going on, in a moment, Krishna picked it up, strung it, and broke it in half. Urukrama means he does amazing deeds. So he's starting to show a little of that. And the sound was so great that Kamsa heard it, and he was terrified. Poor Kamsa. He was, of course, he was such a big demon, killing children, killing babies. Such a big demon, can't imagine. Usually someone like that, they're not afraid of anything. They think they're invincible. But it's starting to dawn on him. Of course, he's been afraid because that curse was there. So he knows that someone's going to come and get me. But now he's starting to, it's coming closer. He's hearing the footsteps now. The cracking of the bow. We'll hear actually the verses that are coming up, how he couldn't sleep at night. It's contrasted to Krishna and Balaram. After this, Krishna and Balaram, they go here, they create all this mischief. They kill the elephant, they break the bow. They just nonchalantly kill all these soldiers. And then they go home, la-di-da, they're just strolling along and just go back to the camp. And they get some hot milk and they get their feet massaged, and then they go to sleep for the night. You know, get ready for the next day. This is just the prelim. This is the preview of coming attractions. Wait till you see what's going to happen tomorrow. This is the Kamsa's. This is the finale. Kamsa's going to get it. So the guards and they're trying to stop Krishna. But what can they do? Just nonchalantly, Krishna and Balaram are killing and strolling around, just enjoying the town. And all the friends are there. I was starting to mention the four kinds of cowherd boys. So the first, they're called Sarit. Sarit means those who are a little bit older. And then Sukha. In general, they're called Vyasas. Vyasa just means friends, Vyasas. So then we have the Sukhas. Sukhas means those who are a little bit younger than Krishna. So those who are a little bit older than Krishna, they have a little bit of the parental rasa. So you might say it's not pure fraternal rasa, because there's a little parental mixed in. And the sukhas, there's a little bit of dasya mixed in. Those who are younger than Krishna, they always want to serve Krishna. They feel a little, because he's older, naturally, they feel some reverence for him. That's the way it was in that culture. So there are some younger boys. If I remember correctly, there it's mentioned that when Krishna stole the gopis' clothes, there were younger boys who were with Krishna at that time. So then there's the Priyasaka, which means very dear, or dear friends of Krishna. They're the same age, dear friends of Krishna. And then there's a Priyanara, they're the same age. So they have complete familiarity with Krishna. Krishna's just their friend on an equal level. Then the Priyanaramasaka, they're also on that level, but the most dear. So among them, the four that are closest to Krishna, the most dear to Krishna, they're, in fact, they are considered to be representations of Krishna's antakarana. Now, antakarana means the internal senses, literally, in the creation. I was talking about creation last time I gave the class. So as part of the creation, but besides the senses, as we know, the five working senses, the five knowledge-acquiring senses, so what's called the internal senses is the intelligence, the ego, the heart. I guess there means the emotional aspect, our emotional side, and the mind. So these four. So Sri Dham, Sudama, Vasudama, and Kinkini. These four are representations of the four that I just mentioned: intelligence, ego, heart, and mind. So it's said of them, there's nothing that Krishna does that they're not aware of, that they don't witness, that they're not part of. All of Krishna's leelas. In fact, these Priyanarma Sakas, they're involved in Krishna's conjugal affairs. They're the ones who go back and forth between Krishna and the gopis, and they help arrange things. Just like the gopis, they have some of the manjaris and others. They help to arrange the union of Radha and Krishna. So there are cowherd boys who also take part in that. And it's said that when they're with Krishna and the gopis, just like we have these leelas of the Dhanak, what is it called? I forget what. Dhanakali is one of them. When they're crossing through, and the Sankhari, I think is, Sankhate, there's that place called Sankhate where they would meet Krishna and the gopis. So the tax collector, toll collector, that. So these different leelas where Krishna is arguing with the gopis and so on. So they're involved in those leelas. And when they're in part of those leelas, they take Krishna's side against the gopis. But when they're only with Krishna, then they stand up for the gopis. They kind of represent the gopis. They take the gopis' side to add some juice to the exchange with Krishna. So these friends of Krishna, they're with him now, and they're experiencing, just imagine the ecstasy they're experiencing. They're also just country boys. And they're seeing how their buddies, Krishna and Balaram, are just coming in and taking over the place. And of course, when this is all done, they're going to have to go back to Vrindavan. We hear about the gopis' feelings of separation from Krishna, but the cowherd boys are also practically dying in separation from Krishna. We heard earlier how when Krishna would go behind a tree, they would practically die. So when he left Mathura for Mathura, then they're also dying in separation. One thing I read, I think this is also in the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, that this leela of separation from Krishna only goes on when Krishna comes to this material world. Because in Goloka Vrindavan, there's never any separation. And there are different verses that support that. So there's a special boost in the depth of the ecstasy when the Of course, when Krishna comes, he brings all his associates. So they get to experience, and in some inconceivable way, both of the things are going on at the same time. So while they're enjoying Krishna's association in the spiritual world, they're also here. The same persons are here enjoying or suffering in separation from Krishna in this material world. So these inconceivable things go on where devotees can be in more than one place at the same time. Worship. Even in this world, there are devotees like Hanuman is in Kim Purusha Varsha, and he's also some other place. So it's so amazing, Krishna's pastimes, and how we get insight into this. Recently, I've been studying the Tattvasandarbha also, and reading Gopi Pranadana Prabhu's commentaries, and also listening to a series of lectures he gave on Tattvasandarbha. And you really get a sense, because he explains about the Vedas. I always have just kind of a vague sense about what the Vedas are exactly and how there was one Veda and then the four and why the four. So he explains all these things. And you really get a sense of how vast they are and how they cover so many topics and how so much of it is just, really, you might say, extraneous. Just like Narada told Vyasadeva, you kind of wasted a lot of time here with all this stuff. So we're so fortunate to get what sadam sadam samudritam, it said that Vyasadeva gave Shukadeva Goswami the essence of the essence, sadam sadam, and he condensed it down. Pibita Bhagavatam rasam alayam, the nectar, drink the nectar, we hear right in the beginning of the Bhagavatam. Because there's so much more. There's so much more that has nothing to do with the real rasa. One thing Gopi Pranadana Prabhu was explaining, he said, even in other sampradayas, Vaishnava sampradayas, Jiva Goswami has categorized the other philosophies and what their absorption is, you might say, of these philosophers or the acharyas in the other sampradayas. Vicharatmika bhakti. You can say their bhakti is vicharatmika. You might say that the heart of it is philosophy. Like in the Ramanuja Sampradaya and the Madhva Sampradaya, they actually like to debate a lot. And they're really into philosophy and defeating the Mayavadis and defeating others. But the Gaudiya Vaishnava, Madhva Gaudiya Vaishnava Sampradaya is rasatmika bhakti. It's about rasa. It's about tasting the nectar. So the nectar, tadvarsa, I quoted this verse in the beginning, tadvarsamrita tiptasya nanyatya syadvati kurchit. That if you taste the nectar of the Srimad Bhagavatam, you'll have no attachment for any other literature. Even other parts of the Vedas, what to speak of the crow-like literature being produced today, you'll have no taste for that. So we have such an opportunity. The Bhagavatam, even the verses themselves, one thing, Rukmini, what's his name? I was quoting his name, Radhika Raman. Radhika Raman was saying, you just chant the verses, even if you don't understand the Sanskrit, there's so much power there in the syllables of these mantras. And there's a mantra that there's a verse that he quoted, I think it's in the Bhagavatam, where it says that Krishna is present in every syllable of the Bhagavatam. So that's why Prabhupada would say, they read one verse, if they read one line, if they read one verse or one word of the Bhagavatam, their life is perfect. Because Krishna is there, they've contacted Krishna. I was thinking about this term Prabhupada would sometimes say, you know, if you do this, your life will be perfect. If you read Bhagavatam, your life will be perfect. If you just chant Hare Krishna and your life will be perfect. So my tendency is to think, well, I do these things, but is it perfect? Or we're trying to get perfection. Sometimes we think, well, it's perfect because we're working our way towards perfection. But there's another way to look at it. The principle, I've come across this a few places from the Acharyas, is that basically perfection means doing what you're supposed to do according to your level of advancement in Krishna consciousness. So sadhana bhakti is perfection. If you're a sadhana bhakta, that's your perfection because you're doing what you're supposed to do. You can't be expected to do something else because you're not there yet. So do what you're supposed to do. Just like even in the Bhagavatam, the 11th canto, Krishna tells Uddhava that unless you're on a certain platform where you can perform devotional service strictly, then stay within the Varnashram. That's the instruction. So you might say the Varnashram is perfect for someone who can't rise above it. But if you have a bona fide spiritual master who's engaging you in sadhana bhakti, then, and you're following that, that's perfection. So of course, part of that whole thing is that we're associating with a perfect literature. And then we have all the expansions. Sometimes it's described how the Goswamis, I think in Krishnadas Kaviraj gives this example of fluffing out cotton. And you can squeeze up, just like we make ghee legs and we make them real tight. But you can fluff them out. So the Goswamis have fluffed out all of this nectar of the Bhagavatam can be increased unlimitedly. The Bhagavatam actually is only 18,000 verses. It's a lot, actually, 18,000 verses. It's a fairly long Purana. We see it's so hard to read. Even to read the translations, I've been reading the translations, and it takes some time just to read through the translations. So the Bhagavatam is 18,000. The Mahabharata is 100,000 verses. So if you ever see one of these multi-volume editions, you'll see how long it is. So the Mahabharata is 100,000 verses. The Goswamis, their combined writings, 1,000,000 verses. So just imagine how much they've contributed to human society, to the benefit of the world. And just like take Jiva Goswami, for example, he wrote, of course, you know, it's heavy philosophy. You read the Tattva Sandarbha. Jiva Goswami was such a genius. I was talking about this professor in the beginning. You know, Nityananda Prabhu told him to go study in Benares, the place where all the Mayavadis are. But he directed him to some Vaishnava. So when he's there, then he's studying Nyaya and Karma Mimamsa and all of these things that just fry your brain. He mastered all of these things. And in fact, he uses some of their techniques. He uses Nyaya techniques in the Tattva Sandarbha. Because they're, in some ways, they're just mechanical, they're technical ways. Even Karma Mimamsa, there are two schools, Vedic schools, which is our school, Vyasadeva's school, Vedanta, and Karma Mimamsa, that actually have some allegiance to the Vedas. The other ones, they don't so much. But one thing, who wrote Karma Mimamsa? Gautam, I think, Gautam Rishi. He came up with a way of studying the Vedas, a system, you might say, of studying the Vedas. So Jiva Goswami, he takes advantage of that, and he applies some of the techniques and understanding and making his points in the Tattva Sandarbha. So he was such a philosophical genius, but at the same time, he's certainly a rasic bhakta. He's certainly got the ecstasy, because he wrote this Gopal Champu, which first of all is extraordinary Sanskrit poetry. And it's also a very, very long verse. I haven't even seen the whole. There's a chapter here and there once in a while. I come across one chapter of it. So, and it's just the most exquisite poetry. Recently, somebody sent me this book. I have it now digital. It was written by Jiva Goswami, I think. Or was it? No, maybe Rupa Goswami. I think maybe it was Rupa Goswami. Where you can do all kinds of things with Sanskrit. And there's a whole genre in Sanskrit, huh? Yeah, yes, Kavitani is called, where you do things like the Sanskrit verse, for example, you can read it forward and it means, it tells one story, for example, and you read it backwards and it tells another story, syllable by syllable. Or the way the syllables are set up in the Sanskrit, it makes some kind of a design. There's all these intricate kinds of designs in the way the Sanskrit syllables are placed. So imagine, just first of all, you're trying to write Sanskrit poetry, which requires you to have a alankar, all these ornaments, and then at the same time you make it fit into this scheme. It's just incredible, the intelligence of these personalities. It's just, well, they're transcendental, obviously. Krishna's guiding them. But even from the material point of view, there are even mundane scholars who write this kind of thing. So when it's applied to Krishna's Leela, then it's just amazing. Of course, unless you really know Sanskrit, you can't fully appreciate it. But if you just look at it at the page, you get some respect for it. So this is the Bhagavatam, of course, it doesn't use this particular, it seems like a sort of a play with Sanskrit where you do these almost like crossword puzzles or something. But the nectar of the Sanskrit verses and the poetry in it, even in the Srimad Bhagavatam, is very, very exquisite. So we have access to this, and so we have no time to waste. Prabhupada would say, don't waste time, because he would always try to impress upon us, there's so much to do. So take advantage of it. And just like this, it's so nice to read this pastime of Krishna. Even here, there's no, I was thinking as I was reading this, there's no purports. And sometimes I think, well, maybe there's no purport because the commentators, they couldn't stop to make a purport. They just wanted to go on to the next. They just wanted to read it. It was so much fun reading it. Couldn't stop to talk about it. It was so much nectar that just reading the pastime is so sweet. All right, so I'll stop here. I won't read everything. I'll just stop. And anybody have any questions or comments? Kamal Harpagul?
The four most intimate coward boys, could you say their names again?
Sakha. Sudit. The first ones are called Sudit.
The four specifically, the Subal and...
Their names. Yeah. Oh, the four, yeah, they're all Dhammas. The first three are Dhammas. Sri Dhamma, Sudama, Vasudama, and the last one is Kinkini. Kinkini. K-I-N-K-I-N-I. Kinkini. So Sri Dhamma, Sudama, Vasudama, and Kinkini. Now Sri Dhamma, he's Radharani's older brother. So he's special already just by that. A very intimate. So just imagine, they're considered to be Krishna's heart and soul, basically, literally. So wherever Krishna goes, they're there. Just like when we go somewhere, our mind is there, our intelligence is there, our heart is there. So they witness everything that Krishna does. It's quite amazing.
I was thinking, Krishna's performing so much extraordinary activities, superhuman activities, daily, so many. But sometimes if one doesn't pay attention, it seems like ordinary. You know, just like breaking that bow. That's a huge, powerful bow. It would take so many men to lift it, you see? And he just snapped it like an elephant breaks a sugar cane. Or, you know, kill all those guys that were fighting with so many weapons. And practically they didn't even have weapons with them, Krishna and Balaram, you see? So they were doing so much superhuman activities, but, you know, if you don't pay attention, you might miss all of these.
Yeah. Actually, today, of course, well, we've always had, we all grew up with Superman, and, you know, so today they have all kinds of action heroes. So they might think, well, you know, my Spider-Man does amazing things too, or this person or that. So what's so great? So one reason we think things are great because, well, we hope, because we're getting some love for Krishna. When you love someone, whatever they do is great. So that's why, you know, as we read these things, our hearts are becoming purified, or they're supposed to be becoming purified. So that's also why we're attracted to these things. See Krishna doing these things. Because we like Krishna. We like what he does. Or we love him, or we're trying to love him. We're gaining step by step. If we hear, with, as with Prabhupada said, submissive oral reception, if we're not critical, and we hear from the proper source, of course. That's another thing that Radhika Raman was explaining, how the Goswamis, this Madhumati one day, she was telling me, she was with a couple of devotees, I can't remember who it was. It may have been Radhika Raman and what's his name, Krishna, that's devotee. I'm forgetting his name. But they were looking at some Sanskrit. I think it was Jiva Goswami's commentary on something. And they were saying, it's so hard to understand it. And she's been studying Sanskrit for a while. Says, it's so hard to translate this, to translate these things. And Jiva Goswami, in his writings. And so Radhika Raman was explaining that, you know, the very high philosophy to, and said generally, Sanskrit Bhagavatam commentary or commentary on the Vedas is written in Sanskrit because that's the language that you can express these things in. Because just like if you read Chaitanya Charitamrita, Prabhupada will say in places, there's no English equivalent for these words. So it's easier to write a Sanskrit commentary than it is to write an English commentary on the Bhagavatam. So what an amazing feat that Srila Prabhupada accomplished was he took this very intricate Sanskrit, these ideas that are written in Sanskrit in the comic, because sometimes I have a tendency to think, oh, well, Prabhupada just read all these commentaries and then he just put it in English. So he didn't work, it wasn't hard work for him. It was already there for him. You know, I have offensive mentality. So no, it's not that easy. He's taking Sanskrit, and which is the language of the gods, and he has to translate it into pidgin English. You know? Our guttural, you know, burps and whatever, our language is so grotesque. And it's just unfit, you might say, for the task of presenting this philosophy. It's like, I'm sure Sanskrit scholars would probably say, and probably had said over the centuries, you can't say these things in any other language. This only can be expressed in Sanskrit. That's the only suitable language to say it in. Just like a highly technical language, if you read something by, you know, some physicist, he's going to use all these words and you're never going to know what he's talking about. But he has to speak that language so other physicists can understand him. So the fact that Prabhupada took this Sanskrit and these commentaries by Sridhar Swami and others and gave it to us, and somebody like Radhika Raman, who understands it, who's a genius, understands Jiva Goswami's Sanskrit. He says, Prabhupada has given us everything. Gopi Pranodana Peru, of course, also the same thing. Prabhupada has given us everything. All the points they're making, he's presented it in a way that we can understand it without confusing our minds, because it can get very technical. If you read Tapasandarbha, one thing that Jiva Goswami does in Tapasandarbha, he has sort of like his own footnotes, Sarva Sambhadini, or like an appendix. So when things get really technical, then he has that in footnotes. So a lot of us devotees won't read that part because it talks about Nyaya and Karma and monks and great detail and so on. So it's like Prabhupada didn't get into all that minutiae to confuse our minds. He gave us the essence. And he gave it exactly according to the Siddhanta. And it's not that he's watered it down at all. It's still there. It's the straight stuff that's presented in a way that we can grasp, even with our Kali Yuga brains. So it's actually miraculous. It's a miraculous accomplishment that Srila Prabhupada has done in presenting this Bhagavatam, his life's work. So his life's work, it should be our life's work to read it. It was his life's work to write it. It should be our life's work to read it. He put so much into it. Lakshmi Mohini Prabhu?
Extraneous material, and then Narada said, well, it's just going to be confusing, people are going to get distracted. And so Srila Prabhupada, when he distilled all the different Sanskrit commentaries, he also gave us the essence. And the sages of Namasharanya, when they spoke to Sutta Goswami, they said, just give us the essence, don't confuse us with all this other stuff, just boil it down. Also Brihat Bhagavatamrita, at the end you find Parikit speaking to his mother, and his mother is saying, just give me the essence, you only have a little while left, just give me the essence. So sometimes we're not so satisfied with the essence, and we go to find the minutia, and then we just get confused, and we wonder, why, I don't understand this, but we're going out of our way to confuse ourselves. Yeah. When Prabhupada went out of his way so we wouldn't become confused.
Yeah, we have to stay within secure boundaries that Srila Prabhupada established for us, so we'll be safe. Mahamaya Prabhu, you had something too?
You said there's some words in the Vedas that are only used there and nowhere else. So I was wondering, or in the Bhagavatam. So, where do you go to translate such a word? Because,
well, you know how Sanskrit works. If you ever look at a Sanskrit dictionary, you'll see it starts with the root, and then you build from the root. Just like when Lord Brahma heard tapa. So Lord Brahma was just born. He hadn't gone to school and learned Sanskrit or anything. But it's the nature of the Sanskrit language that the meaning is present in the sound. But you had to know how to penetrate that meaning. You had to be qualified to understand it. The meaning is present in the sound, but you have to be qualified to extract the meaning. So when the Bhagavatam, when some word is there, maybe some Mayavadi can't understand it, but that doesn't mean that Sridhar Swami doesn't understand it or Jiva Goswami doesn't understand it. They understand it. We see, for example, we read Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's commentaries, what he does with the language sometimes, so beautiful, how he, even his first verse of the Bhagavatam, he interprets it five ways, just to give an example, on five different levels, how you can take the words in different ways. So Sanskrit's an amazing language. It's the language of the gods. So like that, it's not that. Now there are different dictionaries, like the Amarakosha dictionary and the Vishvakosha dictionary. So these, and our acharyas, they quote those dictionaries. One thing about dictionaries is that they're considered, like everybody goes to the dictionary, just like we go to Webster's or whatever, American Heritage, and it's meant to be philosophically neutral. It's non-sectarian. It's not supposed to be presenting any particular point of view. It's just definitions, that's all. So the Amarakosha Dictionary and Vishvakosha Dictionary, they're also supposed to be just definitions of things, not giving a philosophical point of view. But what you find is that sometimes Jiva Goswami, he'll quote some particular word, and he says, this is what it says in the Amarakosha Dictionary, and then you'll see, I think the word kosha actually means dictionary, but it'll actually support some point that he's making about Bhagavan or the absolute truth. In other words, the neutral dictionary is basically supporting the foundation that the absolute truth is Bhagavan, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. even though it's supposed to be philosophically neutral, it can't help itself because it's also Vedic. And ultimately, the Vedas are pointing to Krishna. That's the essence of it. Everything is pointing to Krishna. It's pointing to the Bhagavatam. The Bhagavatam is the crown jewel. You know, the word Purana, a whole part of the Tattva Sandarbha is to establish how the Puranas are the fifth Veda. So Purana comes from the word Purnatva, I think is the root, which means to complete. So in one sense, you can't really say that the Vedas are incomplete because they're Shruti. They coexist eternally with Krishna. They weren't created, they exist eternally. Just like we exist eternally, sometimes we have this idea that Krishna created us, but he didn't exactly create us, just as the sun is there, the sun's rays are there. So we're eternal, Krishna tells us in Bhagavad Gita, we're eternal. So the Vedas are also eternal, the Shruti is also eternal. But in order for them to be comprehensible to us, especially in modern times, the Puranas have to be there. So Purnatva means they complete them. So the language of the Vedas also, or the language of Puranas is also there to help us understand them. So what completes them fully is the Srimad Bhagavatam. You can't really make sense of it all unless you understand Srimad Bhagavatam. You can't get the whole picture clearly tuned in, full high D, high definition vision of Krishna, or the absolute truth, param satyam param dimahi. You don't get that unless you get the Bhagavatam, the picture from the Bhagavatam. And who's helping us see that, of course? The Acharya. Unless you're seeing through the eyes, Acharyavan Purusho Veda, unless you're seeing through the eyes of the Acharya, you won't be able to see clearly. So we can never minimize the importance of Srila Prabhupada and his presentation of the Srimad Bhagavatam. It's without it, we're lost. You know? One thing Radhika Raman was saying, you may know Sanskrit. He said, Prabhupada generally discouraged devotees from learning Sanskrit because it takes so much time. And maybe now our children, you start, you know, in school, we can train them in Sanskrit. There will be some advantage to that. But even if you know Sanskrit and you think, oh, I'm going to read this on my own, you're going to be in danger because you're not going to understand it. Even if you know Sanskrit, you know, you can translate the words literally. That doesn't mean you're going to understand because Sanskrit is not that easy to understand. Because even the Bhagavatam, you want to do your own translation for some reason. It's Krishna. Unless you're seeing Krishna in the words of the Bhagavatam, you're going to get it wrong. You need to see through the eyes of the self-realized soul. All right, we'll stop here. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.